going to get a prop to be a little happier. Dear friends, I'm going to share with you that I have a bit of ill being in the body today. I'm only sharing that. It's some back spasms, I think, from walking around at the march with my still uneven gait. I only mention that in case something herky-jerky happens, you'll know why. So when the Buddha elaborated the way suffering gets made, he did it in many ways, and a lot of them are called dependent origination. It kind of got codified as 12 steps, but that didn't happen till 1,000 years after the Buddha died, probably. But most of the times when the Buddha taught dependent origination, he talked about a lot of things that lead up to birth, and we've all been born, I think, and then birth leading to aging, illness, death, and the whole mass of suffering. So today we're going to explore some of the ways out of that, or to the path to decrease it and ultimately perhaps even transform those things. The Buddha was clear that deep in our consciousness, sleeping in the depths is actually the Pali Anusaya. Are these fears that are acting on our consciousness all the time, whether we know it or not, and that do rise frequently to the surface, and then we do know about it. Freud said some things about death, a death drive, or people refuse to believe that they're mortal. Some things that I didn't exactly understand. And a book was written in the 70s that became very well known, in some circles anyway, called Denial of Death, and by a man named Ernst Becker. And his premise is also that this fear of aging, illness, and death especially are cooking inside of us, and that they're the prime driver for most of the things that we do. So we can say, I exist. And in fact, that they're the prime driver for all of the edifice of our civilization, to be in denial of our mortality. I know they worked on the boiler on last week. My guess is that they weren't too careful in draining the air out of the pipes. So just noticing that. If I were here early enough, I probably would have gotten up there with a radiator key or something. And along with death is that deep, deep fear of annihilation, of becoming nothing. Here's a quote from Ernst Becker. The irony of man's condition is that the deepest need is to be free of the anxiety of death and annihilation, but it is life itself which awakens it, and so we must shrink from being fully alive. And of course, he suggests that many of our motivations, most of the things we do, are driven by that anxiety, are a denial of death. The legend of the Buddha has it that he was raised in an attempt to keep him from all negative things, from any death, illness, any deprivation, hunger, so that, and in the legend, this was because a wizard, a seer, had predicted at his birth that he would either be a great religious teacher or a wheel-turning monarch who united all of the kingdoms. And of course, the legend has it that his dad didn't want him to be a monk or a spiritual teacher, and so in an attempt to do that, he tried to keep the Buddha from all suffering. It's probably not how it went down. The Shakya clan lived in a republic. They probably, you know, his father most likely had a much nicer life than most of the people in the republic, but it wasn't really a king. They paid tribute to the king of Kosala and the Kosalan Empire, which probably was a real king with a lot of the accoutrements of that. Nevertheless, the legend says that the Buddha, one day as he was growing up in his teens perhaps, asked his charioteer to, on the sly, take him out with unaccompanied into the town, into the city. And the Buddha got out there and he saw an old man with a cane hobbling along, and he said to Chanda, his charioteer, "What is that?" And his charioteer mentioned, "That's an old man. That's aging." And the Buddha looked at that and he noticed that he had a revulsion arise in him, and he said, "How odd that I feel this revulsion looking at this old person, and yet I see that I'll become old." Then they came upon a person who was being carried on a stretcher, sick. And he asked Chanda, "What is that?" And Chanda said, "That's a sick person." And the Buddha again said, "How odd. I know that I can get sick, and yet I feel put off by seeing someone who's sick. I feel a revulsion to that." Likewise, he saw a corpse, gray, lifeless, cold, being carried through the streets. And he again felt that fear and revulsion and said, "How odd. I know that I too am subject to death, and yet I feel this revulsion." And then his fourth sight on that day was a monk, a spiritual practitioner, a shramana, who seemed peaceful. And that made a strong impression on the Buddha. And that they came to be called the four messengers. You can do that.
When your electronics are beeping. Maybe your battery is dead or something.
One of my electronics is beeping. Jenny tells me one of my electrical things is beeping.
I've been hearing it too. I've also been hearing it beeping.
I'm not sure. Hold that and see if it's that one. I don't think so. So, what are the fears that lie deep in our consciousness? Annihilation? Death? Oh, I have one. I'll bet you get a little sympathetic response to this. Nursing home. Illness, pain. What is aging? Well, the Buddha told us aging is wrinkling of skin, graying of hair, brokenness of teeth, weakening of faculties, decline of life. This is aging. And when we can bring it up into our consciousness and look at it, smile at it, accept it, transform that fear by bringing it up into our consciousness, then we don't have to have revulsion when we look in a mirror and see a wrinkle. When I look at my arms sometimes and hands and I go, oh goodness, look at that. It really makes life a lot freer. And I go to the dentist and he says, oh, you need blah, blah, blah. And I go, oh, brokenness of teeth. It's just aging. No big deal. So we're going to look at all of these fears in three phases. Recognition, understanding and acceptance, and transformation. As we move forward, a lot of people, this is the five remembrances, of course. A lot of people compare the five remembrances to an inoculation against these fears. And I've decided that that's not wrong, but it's more correct to compare it to the kind of thing that the allergist does, increasing the dose periodically. So some of the images that I'm going to suggest might be too strong a dose to start out with. And if that's true, don't use that particular image. I've found over the years of saying the five remembrances daily at times, that it's nice to increase the dosage of what we're contemplating. So when we're contemplating aging, we can think about some of the pain, some decline of the faculties of our senses, as well as our faculty of movement, so that when we find ourselves hurting on the stairway, we can just smile at that. Aging. Yeah, that's fine. Another thing, we're going to, in around 2013, I think, Tai started giving Dharma talks where he incorporated a Z. Did he do that in 2012?
I think so.
And the top bar The top horizontal line of the Z represents conventional reality, living in the historical dimension. And the bottom one is the ultimate dimension. So in the conventional reality, in the historical dimension, we have birth and death. We have same and different. We have being and non-being. We have discernment. We have inside and outside. Then at the bottom line, in the ultimate dimension, we have no birth and no death, no being and no non-being. The truth of non-being and being is in between those two concepts. Neither one of them is exactly true. No discrimination, no inside, outside. And that diagonal connecting the two, that is the path from conventional to ultimate, and that's meditation and understanding. We'll be concentrating today mostly on the upper bar, conventional reality, but also, if there's time, we can start to lay out the path to understanding these ill-being in the ultimate dimension, transforming it in the ultimate dimension. Taiyo said, I heard him say more than once, I think, that as long as I can practice, doesn't matter what else is happening. And I feel that way also. I've told myself that a lot, especially in the last 6 months. As long as I can practice, that's all. Even if I'm in a nursing home, I can follow my breath. I can contemplate. I can meditate. I can transform consciousness. So as we contemplate the first of the five remembrances, I am in the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. We can recognize it, smile, and accept. The second one, the second remembrance, I am in the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. The Buddha gave us a whole list of diseases, seeing disease, hearing disease, nose, tongue, body diseases, head, ear, catarrh, fever, aging, stomach ache, skin disease, epilepsy, boils, tuberculosis. And that's only a partial of his list. But what I like to do when I'm contemplating I am in the nature to have ill health is really think about that. Think about, what does that mean? Well, one part of ill health is pain. Knowing that pain can exist in ill health. What kinds of ill health? Heart disease. Many of us are afraid of heart disease, of that pain of heart tissue dying, of the shortness of breath that can come from that. The cancer. Being afraid of cancer and the accompanying nausea, headaches. You can choose your own disease to contemplate, your own diseases to contemplate. Boy, that just reminded me of a fire sign theater bit, Name That Disease. But I don't know if anybody's old enough to remember that. Yeah, Jay is. Yeah. So we can sit there and really contemplate it, come to terms with the fact of illness, that, and it is so powerful when we are sick, when we're truly ill, to be able to say, oh, it's just ill health, it's my nature. Guess here I'll begin a story. In 2005, I switched doctors, and you know, they took a full history. And my dad died fairly young, so the doc said, take a baby aspirin every day. And I dutifully took a baby aspirin every day, partly out of fear. I didn't miss many days, and partly following the doctor's orders. And year after year, this went on. In 2009, around 2 o'clock in the morning, I felt very unwell. I went to the bathroom and I said, oh, must have been that tofu I had at lunch. It was a little bit old. Around 5 o'clock, I got up again, and I was sweating bullets. I was dizzy. I was breathing really, really fast. I couldn't sit up. Ended up laying on the bathroom floor. And being a former paramedic, I did a physical exam on myself. And I said, aha, no radial pulse. And I said, let me go for a femoral pulse. Then I said, aha, no femoral pulse. Then I said, what about capillary refill, right? Capillary refill, right, Lana? Well, no capillary refill, which wouldn't be surprising under those circumstances. Then I found I could get a carotid pulse, but it was way too fast to count, probably over 160, 170. And I felt very shocked, felt ashamed, I started reciting the five remembrances. Of course, if you wait till you're sick, it's not any good. But I had been doing it daily at that point for years. I said, oh, love the nature to have ill health. No big deal. It's just the nature of this body. So, you know, you can start with whatever you're comfortable with in contemplating ill health, and then kick it up a notch. Really start contemplating those things, smiling at them, accepting them. Then, of course, the big one. I am of the nature to die. There's no way to escape death. And along with that is the fear of annihilation. The fear of non-existence, non-being, utter, total annihilation. At one level, we can contemplate ways of dying. Maybe you want to think about dying in bed after an illness, a long illness. When I think about that, I think, yes, I have a strong intention to take my last breath in mindfulness. That's not a bad intention. Tai tells the story of Alfred Hustler. Alfred Hussler was the head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and worked with Thay a tremendous amount of time trying to stop the Vietnam War. They were very close. And then at one of the very early retreats in the late 80s up in Rhinebeck at Omega Institute, Thay and Sister Chung Kung had flown into Kennedy, and they were taking a car up to Rhinebeck, and they had heard that Alfred Hussler was in the hospital dying up in Westchester. So they made a detour and to visit him and his wife and his daughter. And Sister Chung Kung sang some of the songs that Alfred Hussler had been familiar with from Thay's teachings. And Thay and Sister Chung Kung, even though Alfred Hussler was unconscious, not really responding, and they said, "Oh, Alfred, remember this wonderful time and these incredible things that you did. And remember the time when we went to that rich woman's house and she was going to give us a donation. She was just about to write the check, and she said, we were having tea, and she said, 'This'll help me be reborn in a fortunate place, in a good place, right?'" And Thay, always the teacher, said, "Well, if everything is empty of a self and is completely impermanent, how could you be reborn?" And they finished their tea, and the woman didn't write their check, and they went outside and just laughed in the driveway, laughed and laughed. And of course, they really needed the money, but they laughed at that. And Alfred Hussler opened up his eyes and said something to Thay. They had to leave, and heard that he died peacefully later that evening. So one of the things is that to remind someone who's dying, or even remind ourselves of the wholesome things we've done, of the wholesome qualities. I couldn't find the poster things, so this is all drawing in air of the, consider another horizontal line. Right there is a dot called B, birth. And over here is a dot called D, death. And we imagine that before this B, we didn't exist, and then B happens, and we exist, and we exist, and we exist, and then D happens, and we cease existing. But if we look into it a little more deeply, we see that that's just not true. We see that the causes and conditions for our birth were happening long ago. Our parents meeting one another, our parents transmitting the genetic information that became us, our parents transmitting a lot of the cultural habit energy information that became us. And where did they get all of that? From their parents and all of their ancestors. So we see that all of our ancestors are contributing. Those conditions are from the very beginning of life, from the very non-beginning of time. Consider this. A feelings, not in the Buddhist sense. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Always, in every moment of our consciousness, we're experiencing either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral affect, a sensation. And of course, what do? We gravitate towards the pleasant and try to get away from the unpleasant. We know mammals do that, birds do that, reptiles do that. The smallest one-celled animals do that. We've inherited that quality of feeling from the smallest one-celled animals at the beginning of life, all the way through the stream of life up to us. Just one example of how all the causes and conditions are going back through space and time. Then we're born, and maybe at the beginning we don't have too many actions radiating out. But then at some point, every action of body, speech, and mind transmits out into the universe, reverberates through space and time, changes our environment, changes the people we're affiliated with. This is our true continuation, one of our true continuations, that we radiate, we transmit every moment that we're alive, transmitting out into the universe. So we can't say that when we die, we cease to exist. We can't say that there's annihilation. What gets annihilated? What dies? Well, I guess you could say this body dies, but it doesn't really, because 3/4 of the body, 2/3 of the body is other beings. And they're having a party if they put us in the ground without all those preservatives. And even the flesh, the bones, you know, they're not the same. Are they the same as they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago? No, they're completely different. Been recycled, all of the nutrients, all of the elements from the earth, completely recycled. So what dies? Not much dies. So when we're considering that third remembrance, we can start to really think about, imagine when it's comfortable, imagine, smile, and accept our death. Another way maybe that I've done it is thinking about a sudden death in a car accident in the rain. How sad, but it's okay. I can smile at that and know that there have been some wholesome things that have been transmitted. If you really want to, if you really start getting comfortable with it, you can imagine the death that you're most afraid of. I just recently started doing that. In my case, I think it's drowning. So I've been imagining that. Knowing that when one is underwater, one tries to breathe in anyway, and gets closed off to the lungs, and you just end up filling up with your belly with water. And it's okay. It's okay. But don't do that if it starts to be too much, of course. As I said, like the allergist, increasing doses a little bit at a time. So in speaking just now, I did something that I do typically when I'm reciting the five remembrances, which is that I went from the third right to the fifth. And of course, the fifth is our actions are our only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. My actions change me every moment. My actions change the universe every single moment. We don't have a single thought, a single speech, a single action that isn't driven by some intention. And that's the good news. That is the really good news, that we can rest easily knowing that we've been transmitting and continue to transmit and can make sure that those transmissions as much as possible are wholesome. That's one of the big things that the Buddha taught, to know this is wholesome, this is unwholesome. This leads to good results, this leads to bad results. Then the fourth of the five is everyone that I love and everything that is dear to me are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. You can, that's a real invitation to look at what we're attached to, what we're clinging to. Job, car, degree, spouse, lover, pet. If we contemplate those things, then when they are taken from us by change, big change or little change, we can go, ah, right. Everything changes. No escape. No escape. Taking refuge in the island of self, in the Dharma body of the practice. And so I was lying there on the floor doing a little physical exam on myself. And I said, obviously I've lost a tremendous amount of blood. That's clear. I'm deeply in shock. All the signs and symptoms are there of a clinical shock, loss of blood, lack of perfusion of the body. And I said, in reciting the five remembrances, I said, I am in the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. I said, yeah, I could die right now. I don't think so, because I'm pretty healthy otherwise, and I think we'll get to the hospital and get some fluids in me and I'll probably be okay. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility here. I've seen people who were this sick die. And I said, my actions are my only true belongings. Cannot escape the consequences of my actions. And I said, well, what have my actions been? Do I have any regrets? I decided I probably did have a regret or two. One of them was maybe not practicing the Dharma deeply enough, not being a strong enough Sangha builder. That was what came to mind then. So to complete the circle, well, let me introduce a bit of a lightning of the story. So we called an ambulance, and I didn't know the two paramedics who came, but you know, I said, you know, I know your bosses and blah blah blah, like that. And they took me to the ER and introduced me to the ER attending, who was this lovely African American woman, and she said, "We're going to take care of you." And she handed me off to the surgical resident. And I noticed the surgical resident didn't really seem to know where things were. I'm going, oh, this is a little odd. Then I looked at my watch and I realized that there's one day when all of in every year when the recently graduated medical school graduates start in the hospital, and it is July 1st. And I looked at my watch, and son of a gun, if it isn't 6:15 in the morning on July 1st, and I started laughing like hell. And of course, the resident said, oh, well, what's funny? And I said, man, I'm your first patient ever as a doc. And he said, yeah, no, there's no other person I'd rather have as a first patient. you know, 28 hours later, after a couple little things, I was out of there. It was very interesting going from critically ill to being released from the hospital in less than 24 hours. Let's see now. So, of course, the ultimate medicine for all of these things is to be able to be in touch with emptiness, to be in touch with non-self. One of the ways of doing that is looking at our connection with the stream of life, looking at how we're not really born, that it goes back forever, and then that helps us release that hold. I don't know, I feel it in my guts when I'm feeling a strong sense of self and feeling so free when I'm starting to let go of it by thinking about that history, by thinking about the fact that, you know, we're composed of the earth, water, air, and fire. The other thing I did all day in the emergency room was recite the Heart Sutra in my mind. Bodhisattva Avalokita, while moving in the deep course of perfect understanding, shed light on the five skandhas and found them equally empty. After this penetration, he overcame all ill-being. Shariputra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. Same is true with feelings. We just looked at how our feelings aren't us. They've been going back millions and millions of years. Same is true of feelings, perceptions. We think our perceptions are our own. I remember people used to like bell bottoms. That was a perception, man, and that was just something from the culture, and most of our perceptions are like that. just taken from the culture, taken from our upbringing, our emotions. We think our emotions are us, are our own. They aren't. Most mammals have emotions. I met a park ranger once in the Everglades who said, yeah, one time I saw a squirrel attacking a snake. And I said, what is that about? That's crazy. And I got viciously attacking a snake, much bigger. And then he said, oh, I got closer. And I saw that the snake was constricting, was trying to kill the squirrel's mate. And the squirrel was trying to defend its mate. Is that an emotion? I'm going to stop. For me, it's an emotion. I think so. You know, our emotions aren't our own. It's really a great contemplation to look at how I am not this body. This body is not me. The body was, am I the same as a baby? 5 years old? Is it the same? Am I the same as when I was five? Not exactly different, fully, but not exactly the same. 40 years old, whatever. To really sink into that meditation of understanding that this body is just a conglomerate of elements formed through some information that was received from generations past, influenced by our actions and what we eat. That's all. There's nobody there. Let's have a bell. The binging stopped?
It's still.
Huh?
It's some other device, perhaps your phone.
Maybe somebody else's. Just one. Dear friends, I'm moved to, and I thought about this a lot, to share some of what the Buddha has taught and some of what Thay has taught about suicide, about taking one's own life. The Buddha seems to have been absolutely opposed to anyone taking their own life. He said that as long as one is alive, there's the possibility of becoming awakened. At some point, he instituted a rule that a monastic may not assist anyone in dying, period. Even to the extent of saying, you can let go now. One should not do that. Thay had a slightly different view. He said, he has said, well, if someone is suffering so much and there's nothing that can be done, nothing that can be done, He basically was like Pope Francis. I can't judge it. But there's almost always something that can be done. Even if you're just going from 100% suffering to 70% suffering, you can, that maybe is enough to live. Tay has also said that we imagine that we can end suffering by killing ourselves, but that's totally not true. And we see that. We see that when someone kills themselves, it transmits tremendous suffering into the world. There's no escape from that suffering. Their continuation ends up totally tinged with that suffering of that final action that gets transmitted out to the world. And sometimes Sister Annabelle has said, if we're very depressed, the only thing we can do is hang on until we're a little better, and then we can nourish our wholesome seeds. But so it seemed really useful to put that out there, suicide in the Buddhist context. Another bell. So I sent out a couple of articles a few days ago about Thay, and then this morning I got a kickback that they didn't go through. So I sent them again. They're interesting. There are different slants that the reporters had. One of them talked about the differences with some of the monastics in Vietnam, some of whom embrace Thay and some of whom do not. That was actually, I found, pretty accurate, as did other people. You can read them. They're out there now. I saw that they went through this time. But I thought I might, if you wanted to, I could share a little bit of actual updates from someone who just visited Thay. Anhung, some of you know, was the seventh member of the Order of Interbeing. She's known Thay since she was a baby. She is his niece. She was part of the first group of lay Dharma teachers who were ordained. She and her husband Thung and their son Bao Thich, about a week ago they got back from Vietnam visiting Thay at the Root Temple. Bao Thich, of course, also is known Thay his whole life. I remember when he was 5 years old, sitting up on the stage next to Thay on a cushion, really straight, quiet. Amazing child he was. And then at 13, he was real smart aleck. And now at 22, he's the most wholesome young man imaginable. Anhung, shared that they went in there and they held Tai's left hand, because that's the hand that's not paralyzed, with both of their hands, each of them. And she said, Tai's concentration is stronger than it has ever been. Even though he can't speak, he looks and he sees deeply, deeply into every corner of you when he's looking at you. She said, his concentration is stronger than it was before he had his stroke. In one of the articles, you'll read that he's given up on Western medicine, which is true, at least as Anhong related. But he is accepting some Eastern medicine. Even some of the people from the country, the healers from the country, and he has them come in to his little hut, and they speak a little bit, and he penetrates into them, and he'll maybe nod yes or nod no. And that actually is exactly the same thing that he was doing in San Francisco when he was in rehab there. And, you know, one of the rehab people was Tai didn't like, and immediately just went and left. You know, had his attendant take him away. So that's, he's been doing that and continues to do that. He has bad days. When he's in pain, he's not peaceful. When he's not in pain, he's very, very peaceful. There was one acupuncturist who Sister Annabelle brought to Tai, and Tai nodded and allowed the acupuncturist to take his pulse. And he said that Tai's life energy is very strong, but even with a strong life energy, that doesn't mean he won't transition at any given point. I was recently reading the death poem of our great-great-grandfather, the founder of this little branch of the Dharma, Lu Kuan. And it's a little sad that I don't think Tai will be able to write a death poem, as it's been, you know, many Zen masters have. But the sisters cook for him and make many delicious little dishes of very small amounts of food. Some days Tai eats and some days he doesn't eat. He sits at a table that looks out on a big window, and the sisters all sit in front of the window at mealtime, so he doesn't eat alone. And obviously he had a strong intention to bring his practice back to Vietnam. And that is why he went to the Root Temple. Along with the memories of training at the Root Temple and his teacher. But of course, Tai is human and he is going to transform at some point, probably, if I imagine, of his choosing. But for now, his concentration is strong. He's peaceful most of the time. And they just were so full of joy to see him. Are there any questions about anything? We don't have too much time, but if there are, I'll do my best.
this is not quite a question, but a thought. I'd like your reaction. I'd like your reaction to this thought. I've given some thought over the years to suicide. And I've seen friends and family from time to time pass away. Sometimes after a while, experiencing great suffering.
Experiencing?
Great suffering.
Uh-huh.
And one of my fears is dying in that way as well. When the teachings, or when you transmit the teachings that suicide transmits great pain, if that's the right, if I'm remembering right, to the world, to the universe, what occurs to me is, so does suffering. So does the person who's suffering transmit great, horrendous pain to the friends and to the family and to the caregivers who want only that person to stop suffering. So I'm at that point where I'm sort of stuck with two seemingly equal and opposite conclusions.
So I have several thoughts. One is that in this day and age, it's mostly unnecessary for people to suffer that much at the end of life. There are a lot of medications. I just, over spring, summer, and fall, was meeting with a man who was dying. And at the end, he was on very large doses of morphine, and he wasn't suffering. If, as Tice said, if there's absolutely nothing, there's almost always something that can be done. But if there's absolutely nothing that can be done, that's, who can say? I don't think that there's an equivalence in terms of the suffering. I think that we saw with Richie the tremendous suffering that got transmitted to our Sangha. Not just out to the universe in some vague way, but just tremendous, tremendous suffering. And maybe there is a point where someone who is suffering from an illness, it would equal that. I don't know. I don't think this is the kind of thing we can really quantify. But even with all the analgesia, all the things that the, what do you call those folks? Hospice folks can offer, and there's still just insane, tremendous suffering that can't be ameliorated. I don't know. I wouldn't, you know, I can't make a judgment that it would be wrong. I can tell you this. One is well served by really, really doing as much transformation as possible before you're getting a lot of narcotics. I did notice that Richard had a strong ego, a strong self, and he knew it. And he wanted to transform, but it was a little too late, because once he started on morphine, that wasn't going to happen. I don't know. Or it didn't happen. It became a complete non-issue for him, and I didn't try and force it on him. So, a little more incentive to practice. I hope that's useful, Stuart.
So from the Buddhist perspective, I seem to understand the idea of continuation in all of the wholesome things someone has done, and continuation through ancestors and people that somebody has touched in the walking, breathing life. I'm just wondering if you can offer anything on the Buddhist perspective, or perhaps your personal perspective on someone's continuation. I don't know if this is getting too tricky, like someone's kind of soul or spirit. My aunt actually just wrote me an email yesterday. Her son, my cousin, died at age 38 of a sudden heart attack last September. And then my grandmother died the year before. And so she just wrote me this email asking some questions. And she said, do you think my grandmother and Sasha reunited? Like, where are they now? And this sense of continuation, I don't know if you can speak to that for people who have passed. Thank you.
So, there are a whole bunch of Buddhists who talk about A, reincarnation, becoming meat again, reincarnation, and rebirth. If you want to start a long, boring chain, go on one of the email lists, that Buddhist email lists, and take a position one way or the other. It's pretty clear that the Buddha did not subscribe to a soul. Thay's deepest teachings on the subject are, any understanding that you have has to incorporate impermanence and emptiness. There's a sutra that Thay calls upon a lot and teaches a lot. It's there's a book about it too. Can't remember the title of the book. It's called the Kacchanagata Sutta. And this monk, who must have been a very deep practitioner, because when people asked the Buddha different questions, he answered based on their ability to understand. And Kacchana says to the Buddha, right view, Lord, right view. In what way is there right view? And the Buddha says, Kacchana, in the world, the people in the world, there are depend on two opposites, being and non-being. They cling to opposite views. This just off the top of my head, not literal, but neither of those is true. None of those opposites are true. Birth and death, being and non-being, inside and outside, discrimination. In the sutra itself, And there's some disagreement about whether this was tacked on later or not. The Buddha uses that as a time to teach dependent origination. Ignorance, not able to see that middle way, not able to see non-self conditions, our mental formations condition our consciousness. Consciousness is none other than our mental formations. Our consciousness considers this thing, this mind-body organism. The mind-body organism conditions the five doors, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and the sixth is the mind. The six sense doors can lead to contact. Contact leads to feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, every moment of contact. Feeling conditions craving. We want to get into something and get away from something. Craving conditions clinging. Clinging conditions bhava, being. Yes, I am. I have a self. Being conditions birth, both moment to moment and cyclically, and birth conditions the aging, illness, death, and suffering. So the right understanding is to try and hit that middle way in our meditation, that middle place between being and non-being. Can you get that? Now, as for your aunt and your grandma, I don't know. Is there some additional continuation that's impermanent, non-self, other than in our people's consciousnesses and other consciousness? I don't know. Even Tayak Tan, who was the right-hand student of Thich Nhat Hanh. When he was dying, he said, nobody knows what happens when we die. Nobody ever came back. But he also said to me one time, "Oh, Dennis," had just been sharing about being ready to die. And he said, "Oh, Dennis, like and not like get us into so much trouble." But so that's my non-answer to your question. Well, we probably ought to wrap it up. Let's listen to three sounds of the bell.
Would your friends please unfold your legs if they have been folded? Can we sing a song? Can we sing a song?
Ask the song.
Does anyone feel like singing?
Maybe we'll sing the song standing up. Does that make sense?